720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I hope you're able to get outside and enjoy some of that beautiful sunshine. It's not too hot, not too cool. It's a nice, lovely day. And of course, we're going to keep you updated on the weather, but looks like we got this kind of beautiful summer weather for the weekend, I'm hoping anyway. So lots to do on the program today. We are going to be talking a little bit about, can you believe this? It is already the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. I cannot believe it's been around that long. And yet it seems like, what in the world did we do without it? So we're going to be talking about that and kind of taking a look at what the next iPhone may look like. We're also going to be talking about a pretty strange lawsuit that we're seeing out of the tech sector. And we're going to be keeping that tech theme rolling and taking a look at some changes at Microsoft. But before we do all that, there is a really interesting thing happening right not so far away from us here in Chicago, and that is in Kelowna, Iowa. A small town has become a landmark in the organic farm movement, and it's all because of Amish farmers who have really helped develop this really dense cluster of organic farms right there in this town in Iowa. But they're starting to run into some issues with some of the commercial organic farmers. So here to talk with us about this story, reporter at Washington Post, Peter Wariski. Welcome to the program, Peter. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so, we don't hear a lot about Kelowna, Iowa, really, but it turns out there that it really is kind of a hub for quite a bit of organic farming. So kind of walk us through how this, I'm going to call it this organic farm uprising, has kind of started.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a cluster. I'm from these. Based on the East Coast, so I associate Lancaster, Pennsylvania with the Amish, but there's a fair number of them out around Kelowna, and they're farmers, and they like farming. It's tough to make a go of it, though, against some of the large players in the industry. And so about 20 or so years ago, they figured out that, you know, organic would work for them because they have small farms. They can make, you know, twice as what they would do on a product such as milk, which is, turns out to be their kind of major crop. They also do eggs and other organics, but milk's really the thing that they got into deeply. And it sort of fit well with their ideals and their health concerns. And, you know, today there's about almost 100 within this very small area, which is a very dense node. There's not a lot of organic farming yet in the U.S.
Yeah, indeed. And for 100 to be right there in this area near Kelowna, Iowa is pretty significant. And so as these, you know, as even places like Walmart and Costco, you know, even as these really, really big retailers, these retail chains are carrying organic milk, you know, obviously demand has gone up for that. And so really organic milk is kind of the center of this battle here right now that Amish farmers are squaring off with.
Right. Milk is the big, you know, maybe the biggest single item in the organic marketplace. I think about 5 billion of it. They've taken about 5 billion in sales in organic dairy products. So it's become very important. It's become very important, as you mentioned, to these very large retailers. What that means, though, is that demand has gone way up and some of the very large players have moved in. As they have, where an Amish guy might have 50, 75 cows, some of these big players have 10,000 cows. And there's now a milk glut because of the over-enthusiasm about the possibility of organic dairy.
And so as a result, prices from these smaller farms are, you know, that's being driven down just because there's so much of it. They're not able to sell for as much. So what is the other kind of piece of this in the story that you wrote at Washington Post kind of hints at perhaps they're saying, no, we are really organic. These commercial producers are not quite as organic as they say they are. There's kind of this this hierarchy of who has more organic cred.
Right. I mean, I think just at first blush, a lot of people would say an Amish guy is probably going to be just at a threshold level more likely to be organic, but we've done some stories, and there've been a few other stories about some of these very large organic operations. At least one of them, maybe the largest, and it supplies Walmart and Costco. And you know, to be an organic dairy, you have to let your cows out. It's like you have to let them graze. It's natural cow behavior. That's what the organic movement's about. And when we went out there, we didn't see very many of their cows, and you know, less than 10% out at any one time. And then we followed it up just to make sure we just weren't, you know, thinking about this correctly. We tested the milk, and it showed that, in fact, they weren't eating grass. They were having other things, so corn probably. So it's not just a feeling among the Amish. It's based on some actual real evidence that these other guys aren't playing by the same set of rules.
Indeed. And so as this kind of whistleblowing is happening, are there, you know, is there any movement to, in this big uprising, in this square off, to put, you know, stricter controls on these large, these larger organic producers?
Well, you know, I didn't just talk to Amish, although that's all I wrote about. I've talked to a lot of small dairy farmers. There's a lot of them that are very upset. Problem with the USDA organic program, the USDA organic program, is that it's not enforced by the USDA itself. It's enforced by a farm hires its own inspectors. Those inspectors are licensed by the USDA, but it's not. So if you, you know, it's a little bit of a conflict of interest because, you know, you might think if you wanted to cheat, you might hire a guy who's not going to look too closely at your operation.
Sure.
And so if they want to fix this problem, they're going to have to look at, I'm probably going to have to look at a different kind of enforcement mechanism, which seems pretty far away right now.
Yeah. So as this is kind of happening, as you say, this seems very far away. What can we do as consumers in the meantime? Is it very important right now to make sure to be supporting smaller farms? And if so, how do we, you know, access them? I think it's kind of difficult if the access you have is a big box store. It's difficult to directly support smaller farmers sometimes.
Yeah, no, it really is. I have three teenage boys, so Costco's a regular stop for us.
Sure.
If, you know, there's a group called the Cornucopia Institute, which is in Wisconsin, which has come up as a watchdog group looking at organic farms, kind of taking, you know, going a little bit farther than the USDA does and making sure the people are really organic. And they have a scorecard or a report card on different dairies around the country, so people can look at that. But the problem, as you mentioned, is just where do you get this stuff? You have to make a special stop. A lot of people also talk about there are other brands out there, and I'd prefer not to endorse one or the other.
Sure.
But there are other brands out there that do a better job of making sure their dairies are truly organic.
Right. Well, it sounds like we all need to do our homework before we hit the grocery stores, for sure, to make sure that we're, you know, buying.
It shouldn't be this way. We should just be able to go and trust it.
Right.
The USDA says it's organic. We should be able to trust it. I don't think right now. I don't have a lot of faith in it, having written some about some of the other issues they have too.
Yeah, you've written so much about this. And I think that, you know, the detail that really I think is very chilling here is about how the USDA doesn't enforce the USDA standards, that you, the farmer, have to go and hire a licensed inspector. And there's so much potential there for, you know, malfeasance or bending the rules or, you know, different standards,
right. Yeah.
Quality standards, which that's a very chilling detail to me. And so it is, there's a lot to it. And we've all been guilty of it. We go to the store and just, it says organic. So we just buy it thinking that it is and it's enforced, but indeed it's fraught. So we appreciate you for joining us today and keeping us informed. And we are going to keep doing our homework a little bit deeper and certainly keep turning to you at Washington Post as this and other stories around this topic unfold. Thank you so much for being with us today, Peter.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. All right. We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about some major, major structural changes that are hitting Microsoft. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little washed out for you there. That's a good jam. I like it. Esteemed producer Griffin Filipich always picks the good music for us, and we appreciate him for that and many reasons. So still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. On the other side of news, after about 12:35, we're going to be talking about the iPhone, because I cannot believe this, but it's already been around for a decade. So we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about a really strange lawsuit that is out of the tech sector right now. I think it's a rather circular sort of lawsuit, but we're going to be talking about that. But right now we are joined by Matt Day, who's a tech reporter at Seattle Times, to give us a look at some of the things that are happening at Microsoft right now. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you taking time out of your weekend to join us. And so lots of changes coming from Microsoft right now. We're starting to see really significant layoffs and restructuring. Talk us through that, about what's going on there.
Yes, so this has become something of an annual tradition there. Microsoft made famous for selling sort of out-of-the-box Windows and Office software. And in the last few years, they've been trying to push sort of on-demand, web-accessed versions of their software. So they've had to, sort of restructure how they both build products and how they sell them. So it's led to layoffs for a few consecutive years here.
And so this particular round is really focused on the sales force. And so what is the larger context of that, in your opinion?
So it's largely Satya Nadella, the CEO there. He inherited a sales force that was built over 10 or 15 years. It was more than 50,000 people, more than 100 countries, right? And they're just a sprawling organization. So as they take a look at trying to sell sort of different products that these folks don't have the expertise for, at some point in the last couple months, it came to the conclusion that they needed sort of significant retooling of that workforce to be able to sell what they wanted to. Right? Folks just didn't have the bright technical expertise in the organization they'd built.
Yeah. So as the new fiscal year started at the beginning of July for Microsoft, we see this memo go out, which I believe how they've handled it before, a large memo, but in this case, certainly a 1,500-word memo went out from the head of sales to all of the sales and marketing employees. And then how long after that memo went out did we start seeing the impact of these cuts and restructurings?
Yeah, so the memo, like I said, came out Monday, and then on Thursday, Microsoft started consulting with the groups and sending out the first wave of layoff notices. So it's unclear, exactly how many of those got taken care of this week. Often when layoffs cover more than one country at Microsoft, they've got to sort of comply with local laws. There are some cases where they'll be announcing things sort of on a rolling basis. So this tends to be sort of a lengthy process. It's not like there were thousands of people let go on Thursday, but that process has definitely started. It's sort of unclear where it goes from there.
And thousands are expected, is what you've indicated in your piece at SeattleTimes.com, which has a lot of really interesting data in there. And so in addition to the staff restructuring, what in the business sense are we seeing shifting right now with Microsoft? Because with any staff reduction, we're going to see something either, departments combined or a new thing launched, something like that. What are we looking at right now from Microsoft?
A lot of it is inside baseball. They've got this alphabet soup of different sales groups, people specified on a single product, whether it's Office or Windows or certain cloud computing areas. They're trying to streamline that a little bit. And again, sort of the broader context is they, rather than just sort of sell people, one time out of the box, Office is on your company's machines, they want a sales force that can go sort of, sit with companies like Pepsi or General Electric or whoever and sort of take them through sort of the new world of on-demand cloud computing software. And they just don't think they have that capability right now. So this is largely a reshuffling of the alphabet soup to try to get to that point where they have a sales organization that can, sort of sit hand-in-hand with those companies and help them out.
But if we're seeing this kind of reduction in workers almost annually from Microsoft, to me that points at something, a larger systemic issue, that perhaps there's some, hemorrhaging going on internally that perhaps, needs to do a more radical shift than just kind of cutting in a race to the bottom.
That's a fair point. And that's some context that's worth bringing up, too, is that they've also been hiring and expanding, sort of to fill these gaps. I mean, when they get to a certain scale where they have to sort of make these cuts, or they feel like they have to make these sort of cuts, they announce those in sort of big chunks. But what you don't often see is sort of the hiring to fill these new roles. I mean, for example, last year there were some sales cuts. I think it was about 900 jobs. But over the same period, they had hired, you know, a separate bucket of 1,000 people with slightly different roles. So overall, the company's headcount has been steadier growing in the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. Partly that's the result of acquisitions, but I think it's they're just looking at a sales force they don't think has the expertise that they want. And there's some criticism about whether or not they can retrain people to get there. But as they've been, cutting some jobs in the last years, they've been hiring pretty significantly as well.
Which to me is a kind of a bigger question for sales in general, connected to the tech sector, especially about, you know, is there such high turnover because it's so difficult to keep people, completely on the cutting edge of technology when they're out selling to clients? And you know, to me, that's kind of a terrifying prospect for someone in the sales and marketing field of just that pressure to stay that on top of things and have that wide of a knowledge of tech. But it looks like that's really the reality of a sales or marketing job in the tech sector right now.
Oh, absolutely. And it's super cutthroat, just the amount of skills you have to keep up on. And particularly for, you know, a lot of the people affected by the current round of Microsoft layoffs, it's folks in outposts, whether it's, you know, field sales and Kansas City or France. You've got to sort of, over the course of your regular job, meeting your targets, you also have to sort of keep abreast of what's going on with sort of the cutting edge of tech and where, you know, new things are going. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I'm sure that's quite a bit of pressure. Well, we appreciate you for joining us today and breaking all down. We'll keep looking to you at Seattle Times, Matt Day, tech reporter there, to keep us abreast of all the latest with Microsoft. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. All right, we are going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. And when we come back, we're going to be taking a look at the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. I can't believe it. And yet, I don't know what I did without it. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Hope you're able to enjoy some of that beautiful summer weather sometime this weekend. It is lovely. Let it call you outside. It is delightful. And as I love to say, your February self will thank you for spending time in it now. So lots to do still here on the second half of the Wintrust Business Lunch show. You know what I cannot believe? And when I saw this story, I thought, surely it cannot be the case, but it is. The iPhone is 10 years old already. I cannot believe it, but indeed, the very first iPhone went on sale at 6 p.m. on June 29th, 2007, which means we have had these in our pockets for 10 years. And joining us now is Haley Sukiyama, who is a tech reporter at Washington Post. Hi, Haley. Welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you taking time out of your weekend to talk with us. So I couldn't believe it when I saw your story. Is the iPhone really 10 years old? But indeed it is. Since 2007, we have been carrying the smartphones and doing all the things. And you wrote this really, really fun and interesting piece in Washington Post about talking to people who were the first to stand in line and get the iPhones and kind of what that experience was like. Especially, I loved the one guy that you talked to who was kind of the first in his group of friends to have one, and he said it felt like a superpower to use one to find a restaurant, which is so fun.
Yeah, I know, and it's funny because he said, I know it's such a commonplace thing now, but you have to imagine, you know, when it was a burger restaurant, they said, you know, where can we get a good burger? He goes, wait, I have the internet. He said it was like pulling it out of his pocket was amazing.
And I at the time I had a BlackBerry, and I remember thinking, like, this is pretty cool. I can do some stuff here on this BlackBerry. And then suddenly the iPhone happened. It was like, wait a minute, this is a game-changing thing. So what surprised you as you talked to people and had them reminisce about getting iPhones 10 years ago?
I think what was really interesting to me, well, there were quite a few things, but I think one thing that was so interesting to me was how, I guess it makes sense. If you're going to spend that much money on something that is really very still speculative, right? People, like you said, the people had BlackBerries, people had other kind of forms of smartphones. And so, Apple made a lot of promises, but, there was certainly no guarantee that this was going to work or that it was going to take off. So I think what really interested me was just how excited the people that I talked to, they were willing to stand in line. They, it was like, a rock concert, or I don't know. It's just this, mm-hmm. it's this funny kind of first glimpse I had of the real devotion that people had to Apple, which of course we've seen play out. But I think, you know, Apple products are now so ubiquitous, and they're, you know, they're in everyone's lives, that I guess I didn't realize sort of how much of a fandom they really had, and, you know, sort of how this crystallized that for a lot of people.
Right. I was even thinking just the other day about the iPod, because someone I follow on Instagram found theirs and was able to still power it up and posted a picture of this, you know, this first gen big clunky iPod. And I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't even seen that in so long. It's so fascinating how quickly, relatively quickly anyway, technology evolves, especially, I mean, in a relatively short amount of time. If we even think about even the idea of just a mobile phone and how the early ones looked and how little they could do, it's funny to think about. Now we rely on them. I mean, I've turned around to go back home by just because I left my phone there. I can't imagine being out all day with that one.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've done the same thing. Yeah. And it's funny because so I've been at the Post now 6 years, you know, covering tech for 6 years. And I found, you know, an older phone, you know, like an it's kind of from the iPhone 4 kind of era. And I was like, wow, this looks so small. You know, and that was not long ago.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm.
It is interesting.
I think about 10 years. Yeah.
Right. It's interesting to see how quickly things change. And we're already kind of starting to look at this, the next iPhone. I think we just settle into the latest when we start, of course, looking ahead. But there's been some consternation. I think people are kind of iffy about the earbud Bluetooth situation. I think some people were kind of funky mm-hmm. about that and funky about, you know, the charger. I know when we moved over to like the lightning cord, people were super mad about that because everybody had tons of mm-hmm. off-brand cords laying around their house. So what do you think we can expect from the next iPhone coming out?
Sure. Well, so the next iPhone, because it is the 10th kind of anniversary year, right, people are expecting for the next cycle of iPhones that there will be at least one that is really, really high-end. Now, I should say, Apple hasn't confirmed anything. Apple is very famous for not confirming mm-hmm. sort of anything, really almost up until the day that it debuts. And so, you know, we sort of rely on this ecosystem of analysts, and, you know, leakers from the supply chain. So everything that we think we may know is, you know, you should still take with a grain of salt. But we are expecting sort of a high-end premium device, and the main expectation is that Apple will move to a kind of full-screen front, so no more of the, you know, kind of buffers at the end. People call them bevels, right? You know, nothing mm-hmm. at the top, nothing at the bottom, nothing on the sides. And no home button, which, you know, it will be really interesting to see how they deal with that.
That will be interesting. And then it looks like that perhaps there's some speculation about the Touch ID being up on the chopping block.
Yeah. So because they're kind of ditching that home button, there are a couple of options, you know, for what to do with the fingerprint reader. One would be to move it to the back, which, you know, is a possibility. There has been some, you know, according to some of the leaks, there's been a little evidence that they might do that. But some people are speculating that they might get rid of Touch ID altogether in favor of facial recognition technology, which would be kind of an interesting decision given how much Apple has pushed Touch ID in the past couple of years.
Yeah, definitely. And I think people are very resistant to facial recognition. I mean, I think even people with nothing to hide, it seems like get, you know, really easily, you know, kind of anxious about that idea. Even on Facebook, when the suggested tags come up, I think people kind of push back on that a little bit, at the idea of being recognizable in, you know, in the matrix, as it were.
No, I totally agree. Yeah, I think I had done a story previously, this is a little bit unrelated, but on, you know, Delta testing out facial recognition technology for check-in. And it was really funny to kind of see some people were like, oh, yeah, that'd be super convenient. You know, I wouldn't have to fumble around with my boarding pass. And some people were like, no, I do not want that.
Right.
It's very interesting, a dividing technology.
Right. I think that will be interesting to see. And then a lot of conversation, particularly kind of, I think, in the wellness realm about screens and that light emitting screen and what it's doing to our sleep and our brains and our, you know, it's wiring us to respond with a, you know, hoping for a little hit of dopamine at every little noise our phone makes. So a lot of consternation around that light. And so it sounds like perhaps there's a little bit of thought being put into that too.
Yeah, definitely. So Apple already has something called a kind of a night mode that you can have, you can put onto your phone and do a little bit more, but to more of a red light rather than a blue light, which I think the wisdom is that the blue light is the one that is really sleep disrupting. And sort of just really looking at more of that light technology, more of the do not disturb functions, you know, just really trying to keep people a little more off their screens. But, it's a hard battle. I think if any of us have thought it ourselves, we know that is a difficult thing to do.
It's true. You know, someone gave me the advice of switching over to kind of make the screen look like a photo negative to kind of invert the colors. And that is how, because I wake up in the middle of the night and just can't go back to sleep. And I just start tweeting with people. But I have found that that helps me fall asleep a little bit faster when I switch it over to that. I mean, it looks like a Pac-Man screen, but it works. I swear by it.
Well, that's a good tip.
Yeah.
I actually sleep with my phones outside of my bedroom
because
kept working. Yeah.
Good for you. That is admirable discipline. Good for you. Nice. Well, so then do you have a separate alarm clock?
I do. I have an old-fashioned alarm clock. It helps.
I admire that. I admire that very much because I use my phone for everything. I don't use a watch. I use my phone. I don't use an alarm clock. I use my phone. But then you'll also see me tweeting at 4 in the morning. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much, as always, for keeping us updated on all things technology-related. And we will keep looking to you at Washington Post as the new iPhone details are confirmed. And I'm sure everybody will be all a scramble for that one, too. No doubt. Thank you so much, Haley, for being with us today.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. All right. We are going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about a really unusual and sounds rather circular lawsuit happening out of the tech sector right now. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. In just a bit, we're going to be turning things over to the Startup Showcase, and we will hear from our good friend Scott Catoon here in just a little bit and find out what he's got going on the show. But before we do that, there's still plenty to talk about here on the show. And we're joined now by New York Times reporter Daniel Victor, who has written a really interesting story that I had to read the lead of it a couple of times because I wanted to make sure that I had it right in my head. But essentially, Distractify, which is a viral content site that you have definitely seen on Facebook, even if you don't realize it, they fill news feeds with a lot of mostly feel-good kind of posts. They mostly repackage other content from other websites, but they're suing another site that's saying it repackaged content from its websites. What? There's a lot going on here. Help us out, Daniel.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Like you said, Distractify is one of those websites that finds a lot of content on the rest of the internet that you're very likely to want to look at. You know, it's, like you said, feel-good stories, it's funny memes, interesting social media posts. They're very, very good at writing things and writing headlines specifically that are going to make you very likely to click their stories and share them with friends. So surely you have at least one Facebook friend who shares Distractify all the time. But a lot of these stories are things that are covered by a lot of similar viral content sites. And so they're all looking at the same Reddit posts, they're all looking at the same celebrity tweets, all that kind of stuff. So what's happening here is they're accusing another website, 22Words, of stealing their content, of infringing on their copyright. So it creates some interesting questions of how these sites get the story ideas and what exactly they do have ownership over.
Indeed, especially when there are so many sites that are really not necessarily making their own content as much as they're linking off to so many other sites. I mean, I'm thinking of their sites I really like that do that, like Geekology is one. Boing Boing does that. Mm-hmm. They'll kind of write one or two graphs and say, here's the deal with this, read more here, and send you off somewhere. So it does get into kind of an interesting discussion about, well, you know, where where is it that you officially are owning something and plagiarizing someone? And in this case, there's 51 times that Distractify says that its copyright was violated. But a lot of times we're talking about just a headline that mostly would be worded that way by anybody.
Yeah, a lot of the headlines are kind of comically similar. So this one example is Craigslist seller posts hilariously honest description of his $900 car. And then 22 Words took that and said, this is the most hilariously honest Craigslist description ever written for a car. So it's clear that it uses some of the same phrasing, but they've made some slight modifications there. What's interesting is that they can't necessarily claim that they have a copyright to the headline because it's so short. They also can't necessarily claim that they have a copyright to the story itself because they found that on Craigslist. So the claim that they have is essentially that 22 Words has plagiarized them. But it's important to note that plagiarism by itself isn't illegal unless you're plagiarizing copyrighted material.
Right. And this is where this starts getting really interesting. I feel like this is another example. We talk about this all the time on the show. Another example of how law just cannot quite, stay quiet. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to keep scrambling to keep up with technology, and all these really interesting, unprecedented things hit the legal system when you have to kind of, okay, stop and say, okay, well, what is the, you know, how long does it have to be for us to protect copyright length? How many words must you take for it to be plagiarism? And, you know, where does it fall for a headline? It is a really kind of interesting thing. And so do you get the sense that this particular case is going to shift how a lot of these curation sites function?
I think that depends a lot about the result, of course. The lawsuit was just recently filed, so we don't have any results yet. But you're absolutely right that copyright law was not written for the current era that we live in. You know, it was written for an era where the Washington Post would write an 800-word story, and then if the New York Times took all 800 words of those and printed it the next day in the morning paper, that would, of course, be a copyright violation. But if the Washington Post writes an 800-word scoop and the New York Times takes 100 words of it and rewrites it and says, you know, the Washington Post first reported that, that's not necessarily what the purpose of the copyright law was. So they're looking at this as a possibility, you know, if they can say that because we first covered the 20 most interesting Anna Kendrick tweets and 22 Words collected a different 20 tweets, if they can truly say that we have a copyright to that concept, then that would change the entire nature of the viral economy. I will say, however, that the lawyers I spoke to were pretty skeptical that that would be the case.
Is that right? I think that that's an interesting detail, too. And you know, as we're looking at these two companies in particular, Distractify and 22 Words, which do essentially the same thing. I feel like I see them both in my Facebook feed mm-hmm. all the time. It will be really, I think it'll just be an interesting conversation to kind of look back on how this case plays out, because there's legal issues, but there's also kind of ethical ones, because attribution mm-hmm. is such a big part of when you're linking off to other content. Most sites do it really well. They'll say, here's the deal, and then click here if you really want to read the in-depth piece. And in fact, I think it's important to note that 22 Words has linked to Distractify and given them credit a few times, but not
correct.
For any of the pieces that are in question in this lawsuit.
That's correct. And even Distractify has given a hat tip to 22 Words on well over a dozen occasions. So it's clear that the sites are looking at each other. It's clear that they're getting ideas from each other. It is true that the ones that Distractify has cited in this lawsuit, for the most part, did not attribute to Distractify. However, it's also important to note that simply attributing to someone else isn't necessarily a defense if it were a copyright infringement.
Right. And so you talked with some folks from Electronic Frontier Foundation, which does a lot of really important work in this realm. And what was their position on this?
Their position was that this is an interesting case to watch, if nothing else, because it's not just a matter of publishers and their copyrights. It's also a matter of original content creators like photographers. So I found a photographer there was a lawyer who has twice sued Distractify for using photos without permission. So if Distractify were to say that this article has a copyright, then you would have to raise the question of, well, if we're getting these comments from Reddit, you know, Reddit users who have shared their wedding stories, does that mean that those Reddit users would then have the copyright, and would Distractify be liable then? So there are a lot of elements, a lot of layers to this.
Really, really, truly, so many elements to this. It's really, really fascinating. Well, I'm with them. I agree with Electronic Frontier Foundation completely. I think this is just going to be an interesting thing to watch and see how it plays out because of all these details. And I certainly would not want to be counsel for either party because it seems endlessly confusing for sure. But we will keep turning to you at New York Times to keep us updated on this story. Thanks so much for being with us today, Daniel Victor, reporter at New York Times.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, we are going to take a little break, and then we're going to catch up with Scott Catoon and see what is happening on the Startup Showcase today. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
720 WGN.
720 WGN. That was the shortest darn break I've ever heard in my life. These little tiny, tiny breaks, but that's all good. My mind is kind of reeling from that last story, Griffin. I don't know about you, but I really would not want to be counsel for either party in that last one. But I am so interested in that particular area of law because as we think about the tech world and how just 24 hours can mean a change in some innovative practice or new thing and new concept, I think the law struggles to keep up with it sometimes. I mean, we've seen this in so many things, and we've even seen this with, you know, behavior online. We've seen this with how people and what people say on social media. And I just think that's an endlessly fascinating topic because it, in that respect, it is a bit the Wild West when it comes to tech things. And so
And you'd expect a website like Distractify to know that and be taking advantage of it and then expect the law to protect them in some way that they thought they could skirt previously. Not that that's necessarily the situation, but you'd think that they are kind of taking advantage of the fact that they don't have to attribute everything and then expect it to protect them in the opposite way.
Yeah.
But it can't keep up.
Yeah. No, it can't keep up. And it usually takes one of these kind of cases to become, to become the thing that sets precedent for that. Unfortunately, you know, lawsuits are not fast. They don't go quickly. It's easier to file them than it is to see them play out. So it'll be interesting. So we're going to keep turning to Daniel Victor at New York Times and other tech writers to keep us updated on this. And what a time to be covering the tech industry, I think, from the, you know, recent outpouring of sexual harassment claims around venture capital to the legal area alone, I think could keep you very, very, very busy. But let us save that conversation for another day on the program because we are now joined in studio by our good friend Scott Catoon, who is here to take the wheel for Startup Showcase. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Good. What's happening today on the show?
We've got a couple cool things. Speaking of women in tech, Chicago is just named the number one place for women in tech in the country, with 30% of the startups here in the Chicago area are founded by female founders.
30%? I love that.
That's by Compass. So, sometimes Compass is
50.
Well, I agree. And so we're going to have, speaking of that, Women Who Code is back in Chicago.
Excellent.
We have one of the directors who's going to be on the show with us. And then Sean Fralick, who hosts The Feed, is going to be my co-host today. So we can talk about a whole bunch of stuff in the media space. And just to jive a little bit with what you were talking about with the sexism going on.
Yeah.
I had a bunch of tweets back and forth with Chris Sacca, who is one of the people in that article.
Yeah.
And he took an approach that I thought was kind of different by just saying, yeah, I'm guilty and I did all these things wrong and I learned a lot and, you know, whatever. But rather than just ignoring it and disappearing from the conversation.
He used another word, too. I think he said, I was a creep.
Yeah, called himself a creep, which I kind of respect the guy who comes out and just says, listen, I'm not a good person for what I did.
I agree with you. I wanted one more beat there.
Yes, there's
and
a whole
I will do the following.
Yes, it would have been nice, but you know, we got that much, so that's good.
I was a creep, and here are the steps I'm going to take to stop being a creep.
We had some good Twitter exchanges, so I can't say it on the air some of the things he said, but I think he actually got the
you schooled
him. I'm a creep. Well, I didn't have to school him anything. He just kind of got like, wow, I was a creep and I didn't really think of myself in a creepy way. And now I do. And it's kind of weird.
See, to me, that points at we need a bigger culture thing. If you can be doing that and like not think you're a creep.
And I'm hoping, And I'm hoping that we're building that in Chicago, that if you
I
act
so
that
too.
Way, you're going to know that you're a creep.
Yeah. And here's what's cool about Chicago. Here's why we have an advantage in that area. It's because Chicago is the biggest small town in the world.
Oh my God. Yes.
And everybody can play Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon. Chicago is Kevin Bacon.
Yes. I totally agree. Yeah.
Everybody can be. I think we're in four, not even six. I think probably. In four people, everybody in this town can be connected.
There's no
somehow.
Way that you and I both are not connected to someone who just walked by this window.
There's no way in the absolute
Literally,
world.
No way.
And so I think there's you just can't get away with stuff like that here because everybody would hear about it and it would like get back to your relatives quickly.
Well, if it wasn't sunny, I would tell you to just hang out with us and continue this conversation. Cause this is, you're going to hear more of this when we come back after the break here. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGN Radio.